I'm David Brown, and this is Business Wars. The fight between Death Row and Bad Boy Records lasted less than a decade, a mere blip of time in the over 50-year history of hip-hop music. But the impact of that conflict and its aftermath is still felt today. The Notorious B.I.G. and Tupac Shakur were the most high-profile casualties of this music industry brawl, but it damaged the lives of those that survived, too, in particular Faith Evans, Notorious B.I.G.'s widow, and the subject of salacious, unsubstantiated rumors that the rift between the rap icons was in part due to Evans having an affair with Tupac. Those rumors put Evans in the middle of a deadly rivalry, and speculation about her involvement follows her to this day. Perhaps that's because of the lingering questions around the investigations into the murders, or maybe there's something more. Something about how women are treated both in the hip-hop community and the music industry as a whole. For more, I'm joined by Naima Cochran. She's a music and culture journalist and former industry executive who's worked behind the scenes shaping the careers of Beyoncé, John Legend, Juicy J, and other major artists. We'll explore how the rivalry between Death Row and Bad Boy Records changed the rap game and look at the rivalry from the perspective of the female superstar caught in the middle. All that's coming up next. Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's vice chair and president, Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though many of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill talk about how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can check out this episode and a whole lot more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/business.
Naima Cochran, welcome to Business Wars.
Thank you for having me.
We know how important the music of this era was, but what kind of impact did the gangster rap movement have on the business of hip-hop?
The most immediate impact on the business side was that hip-hop, which had become a very welcomed commercial commodity, was in danger of being marginalized again. In the early days of rap, it was difficult for an all-rap tour to get venues, you know, for promoters to take it on, for venue owners to want to do it. There were some issues in the late 80s where there was a lot of violence at different shows and concerts. So we went through almost a decade of not being able to get massive venues for an all hip hop bill, right? Yeah. So just as we're coming into an era where, you know, after Yo MTV Raps and after rap is starting to go mainstream, people are recognizing that they need to be in this business. This was giving a reason not to be. So I would say that was most immediate. The second is, of course, the loss that we'll never be able to fully measure of two prime artists cut down in their early 20s. We'll never really know how that reverberated throughout, you know, hip hop history, what it would look like.
What might have been.
Yeah, what might have been.
Hey, let's pick up on that, because in the 90s, you start to see rappers crossing over and becoming megastars with both black and white audiences. How did the artists react to that newfound fame and recognition and, you know, the scale of this thing just exponentially growing?
Well, you know, a timely quote to consider what we're talking about is Big saying, we never thought that hip hop could take it this far. I think that there was a different level of reaction because, these, you know, one of the things we have to remember, David, is that these were very young people. Big died at 24, right?
Yeah.
I think Pac was around the same age. So these were young men who had a lot of money and a lot of recognition very quickly. Even the label heads were young, right? The boundaries of hip hop hadn't been hit yet. I won't say they have now, but there was still just so much unexplored territory of what could be created and what could be done and new lands to conquer, et cetera. So I would say, if anything, it really kind of added to this sense of invincibility, this sense of almost like, you know, the world is yours, right?
That's so interesting because I was thinking, contrast that, right? That attitude and that style with, say, the general public's understanding of gangster rap at this time.
It's no secret that a lot of early hip hop artists especially used the music as a form of escape, used their talents as a form of escape from cycles of poverty, cycles of violence, an alternative to ending up in jail for an indefinite period of time. But there was not an impoverished mentality amongst these people. There really was an idea of like, we're going to make it out by whatever means. I don't know if the public outside of, I guess, Black listeners, for lack of a better word, or core hip hop consumers really kind of looked at it like, oh, the tragedy of this. And there was tragedy in it, but it was also kind of like we're gonna get ourselves out of this situation. And again, very, very young people, right? But then going to your point about the attitudes that they had amongst themselves, like I said, there was a world is mine attitude and invincibility. Pac, especially by the end, was really almost openly courting death. Mm. The alternate theory, or one of the dominant theories, I should say, about why he got killed had nothing to do with the East Coast, West Coast beef at all, but possibly because he was taunting gang members. And stepped to someone who was very senior, and it was a retaliation.
Let's go deeper on that East Coast, West Coast beef, as you were referring to it, right? I mean, I think as hip-hop's mainstream popularity began to grow, we also saw tensions grow between East and West. And I think a lot of people have difficulty wrapping their heads around why was that a thing? What was this beef really about?
So, and I also do want to add in here, while the East and West were focused on throwing shots at each other, the South emerged as a stronger, viable contender in the midst of all this.
Atlanta and Houston and all of that, for sure.
Exactly. Infamous 94 Source Awards, Outkast wins Best New Artist, but also that's the same award show where, you know, Suge and Snoop were addressing beef from the stage. You know, so this is all happening like in the same era. So honestly, the thing about the East versus West, in my opinion, in my very humble opinion, is that it started as something very small that could have been squashed, that was inflated into something really major. What really happened was we had a very angry and sensitive Pac. And I don't mean that in a negative way. He had been through a lot in a short period of time. And by most reports, after he came off of the Juice shoot, the movie Juice, in which he played a person who very quickly got very angry and kind of turned on all his friends, there was an element of that character, Bishop, that never left Pac. So this is around the time that we go from a keep your head up, Pac, to Pac is on UMTV Raps. He's cussing out the Hudlin Brothers on, you know, arrests follow, other drama follows. So Pac is actually an East Coaster by birth and raised. He's not a West Coast dude, but now he's signed to a West Coast label. And he actually was cool with Big. I don't know if anybody would go so far as to call them friends, but they were definitely associates. They had definitely hung out. And he was recording in the studio where Bad Boy usually recorded. He got shot in the lobby of that studio, and he always believed that if it wasn't people with Bad Boy, if it wasn't Big and Puff and Bad Boy affiliates who set him up directly, they knew about it and let it happen. And that was the kernel of this. And what happens right after that is that Biggie drops a song called Who Shot Ya, which actually was recorded long before this whole situation even happened.
Wow.
But so Tupac hears it. A bunch of people hear this. Because if you hear it, it sounds like it could be about Pac getting shot. And that kind of sets off this little war. And I think that Pac decided that even if he knew it wasn't them, he said it so much that he decided it was, like, it didn't even matter anymore at a point, you know? And you end up with this, you know, years long. Because it wasn't, not only was it not a decade long, I think at most it might have been like 3 years long. It wasn't long at all. But it just felt very heavy and intense for a minute. And you end up with this like historic East Coast, West Coast beef, which, and now, you know, from the perspective of 20 plus years away, it's kind of like, it's kind of hard to remember how serious it really was. Like, people afraid to travel coast to coast, you know?
You know, you set up that bookend so well, you know, how this sort of got rolling. And then you think about what that other bookend is. That's, you know, basically the rivalry between Tupac and Notorious B.I.G. ending with the death of both artists. Do you think that there was a sort of collective understanding in the industry or among artists that something had to give? Can you describe sort of what happened there?
I think that when we lost Pac, there was definitely a sense of this shit is getting too serious, right? I don't think there was ever an actual truce brokered per se. I just think that the spectatorship of it went away. I think fans were traumatized. I know that executives were traumatized and people who worked with these artists were traumatized, you know. Families were traumatized. It was just enough. Big and Pac were the centerpieces of this, and Big and Pac were gone. And then all of a sudden it all felt very silly.
Naima, you entered the music industry in the late 90s, as I understand it. This is sort of after all, just right after all the dust had sort of settled on this battle between Death Row and Bad Boy. How did everything that went down seem to change the hip hop that followed? I mean, both creatively and, you know, from a commercial standpoint, too.
I came in at the beginning of the rebirth. Let's put it that way, if you want to call it that. So I actually went to Bad Boy to work in the A&R department. And I'm not going to say that there were a bunch of, you know, conversations about Big all the time and stuff like that. They happened, but it wasn't necessarily a label that was hanging on mm-hmm. Big, but it was watching this label with this massive shadow of Big hanging over it, because it was mm-hmm. yeah. rebuilding. So now Mace is there. Now Puff has stepped into an artist role. They are signing new talent. And now, you know, it's the producers kind of at the helm and just racking up number one after number one after number one. And we were also coming into a new era of hip hop, period. It was the bling era. It was the party era.
I mean, how did the music sound relative to what had just immediately preceded it? I mean, was it lighter?
Yeah, it was lighter. Because all of a sudden what we have is rappers who have now brokered really lucrative deals. There's a lot of money in hip hop at this point. There's a lot. So instead of rapping about being on the streets and getting out, now you're talking about you made it out. And this is what we're doing. We're on jets. We're in Central Pay. We're in the Hamptons. That's what it was. It was a celebration. We made it. We made it. We're here. We survived.
So given that sort of backdrop, and I think a lot of people, you know, that what you're describing there resonates with a lot of people, how much does gang culture still influence modern hip hop, or has that ship sailed, so to speak?
No, actually, the ship definitely hasn't sailed. Gang culture is still around. There are still artists in the industry who claim one set or another, but not to the extent of like, we're going to go to any kind of war over it. There are right. still certain artists where if they travel to certain places, they check in with somebody first to make sure that they're good to kind of get a pass to move around safely. All those things still happen. The other thing is that it doesn't happen in the same way it did in the 90s, because you have to remember that that's the late 80s, early 90s. We're in the middle of just a different culture of the street, period, in New York. LA gang violence was astronomical. And even though it still exists, it's nothing like it was back then. We're in the midst of the crack epidemic. You have more people with closer connections to somebody who's in a gang or sells drugs or, you know, just got out of jail or got killed. I think now we have maybe more distance between those things because it just the street isn't the same, right? But it still exists.
Man, this is amazing. context. Naima Cochran is a former music executive who's turned a culture journalist, and she is our guest today on Business Wars. We're going to have more coming up in just a moment. Stay with us. You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers. Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town, and there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. As business owners and managers, you use software for your business every day. You use one piece of software to manage your customers, another to manage your employees, another to manage your finances, and the list goes on. You buy these pieces independently and hope they fit neatly together like a puzzle. And then you find out the hard way that they don't, and you end up with a mess at the heart of your business operations. Does any of this sound familiar? Well, fortunately, Zoho offers a solution to this chaos. It's called Zoho One. Zoho One is a suite of around 50 pre-integrated business applications that fit together beautifully. So instead of dealing with disparate software from multiple vendors with multiple contracts and price points, you deal with one vendor with all the pieces of the business software puzzle neatly put together, offered at a very attractive price. Now, if this sounds interesting to you, you got to check out Zoho One at zoho.one. That's Zoho.one. With Zoho, you're not just licensing apps. You're licensing peace of mind. Welcome back to Business Wars. I'm David Brown, and our guest today is Naima Cochran. She's a former music executive turned culture journalist. And we're talking about Death Row, Bad Boy, and everything that's come since. You know, Naima, it's difficult to talk about this battle without mentioning Faith Evans. She's often been called the first lady of Bad Boy Entertainment after her brief marriage to the notorious B.I.G. Faith ended up right in the center of the drama, in a sense. Can you describe her involvement in this story?
What people know is that at some point Faith was seen with Pac, not necessarily canoodling or anything like that, but just seen with him at a restaurant, maybe in another place or so. What people really do need to remember about Faith, though, is that she was a songwriter. She was a songwriter before she was even signed to Bad Boy as an artist. She was a songwriter before she was married to Big. And she could have been with Pac for any number of reasons. Some would still say it was a violation considering what was going on with him and Big. But again, we're talking about very young people. Who knows where her head was? To my knowledge, she's never really addressed it, right? But what did happen was Pac, in his pettiness, because he could be very petty, was more than happy to make insinuations on wax, and Big jokingly threw him back in a self-depreciating way. And I can't imagine what that had to feel like for her at that moment, to have her to be made like kind of a pawn between these two men in this very public spectacle of, you know, a rivalry. I do think that as time has gone on, people have been too eager to believe the boasts of rappers to be fact, instead of just braggadocious, you know, lyrics.
So do you think that that affected Faith's own music career?
The only thing I think that might have been really complicated for Faith in terms of her music career was just her relationship with Bad Boy as a label. It's not like Big brought her in. It's not like Big discovered her and signed her. She was already here. She worked on Usher's first album for Bad Boy, which came out in 1994. I think it was her being in the studio around that time when she was introduced to Big. But again, her career was not dependent on him.
How did the media portray Faith as all of this was going on?
Really kind of as we're kind of talking about her right now, like, right? On the one hand, overlooked in the midst of the turbulence going back and forth between East and West. But also, because she was an R&B artist, she was still able to kind of stay removed from it. Now, had she been a rapper, this may have been a totally different story. You know, if we're talking about, if Kim was the one who was married to Big and Pac was talking about Kim, this may have been different because Kim would have fired back lyrically and or, you know, it would have been a different situation. But Faith being an R&B artist, she was kind of able to like sidestep all of that. Like, my lane is over here. Y'all do whatever y'all doing over here. I'm over here. And also because she's an R&B artist, that's an audience that's very sympathetic and very supportive. I think she ever lost fans over it. Nobody that I knew, nobody that I heard talk about it was necessarily mad at Faith or turning a blind eye from Faith. Or like, I'm not listening to any more Faith albums. Because also Faith was so immensely talented. Mm-hmm, right, mm-hmm, that mm-hmm. that you couldn't really just dismiss her out of hand, even if you wanted to.
Do you think then, if someone were to say, well, you know, Faith was kind of used in a way as a sort of a character or a prop in this dust up that became Deadly, right? Is that, what would you say to someone who said that?
I would say she was one of Pac on Hit 'Em Up said blatantly, that's why, you know, F to B, and Big has a joke where he says, Faye has twins, Faith was pregnant, Faye has twins, should probably have two pocks, you know, get it, two pocks, you know, so he's actually like making punchlines of it. But again, I was in like kind of like a self-depreciating way. I would definitely say that that they both used her for fodder. I could definitely see that, you know, Pac didn't mind being seen in public with her because it was going to be a dart to Big and his ego. Right. And at the time, Pac wasn't publicly with anybody, so it's not like they could turn around and do the same in Suit. So yeah, I would say she was used as a pawn. Would I say she was the biggest prop? Would I say she was a pivotal prop? Would I say she changed the escalation of any trajectory? No. But that's a convenient move to be like, ha ha ha, I got your girl. A bruise to the ego.
You know, you think of many of the women from hip-hop's golden age, Faith Evans, Queen Latifah, Mary J. Blige, still big names today. But getting to the top of a music scene that was dominated by men, that couldn't have been an easy climb. I mean, what was the reality for women in rap at that time?
I might call this like the second generation for women in rap. The first generation being Roxanne Shanté, Ro Roxanne, Miss Melody, Queen Latifah, like you mentioned, MC Light, they're moving into Salt and Pepper, like the ones that got started in the late 80s. And then now we're moving into these rappers who are proteges of and actually kind of mirror images of the men who discovered them or the men who they are introduced by, right? So Kim was Big and a smaller, sexier, body, right? She had his same swag. You know, he was like, this is mine. So now you have these women who aren't just coming out trying to match the men or go toe-to-toe with the men just lyrically, but also like, if you're gonna rap about monies and cars and broads and sex, I'm gonna rap about money and luxury items and cars and men and sex. Like, why? It's quid pro quo. Why not? And that was new. I would say an earlier group of women MCs were actually trying to maybe downplay their sexuality a little bit. I would say this is the first time. It's like, I'm also going to play my sexuality all the way up. I'm going to use it. Even now, we're seeing that conversation come around again last year with Cardi and Megan Thee Stallion with WAP. People were having full aneurysms and conniptions about the song. I'm like, we've been through this 20 years ago. What is wrong with y'all? You know, it's like, it's not, this is not new, guys. You definitely were dancing. You definitely had the first Lil' Kim album. You definitely had the first Foxy album. Like, you can't be serious.
Well, pick up on that then for just a minute, because you're talking about Cardi and Megan Thee Stallion. Okay, so what is it that makes the careers of these women different from the ones who rose to fame in the 90s? I mean, if you're going to draw that line right there.
We'll back up for a little bit. So before Cardi hit her success in the last few years, the last really dominant woman in rap that we had that was crossing over, that was hitting the top of the Hot 100, was Nicki. Nicki had like a decade to herself, Nicki Minaj. And Nicki was one of the last women to come out of one of the last rap crews, which was Cash Money, Young Money. We don't really have rap crews anymore either. So when you get Cardi, Cardi was not co-signed by a male rapper. She is her own artist. All the things that used to be the traditional entree for women mm-hmm. into the scene, none of that. None of that for her. And same with Meg.
You know, and it's interesting how this phenomenon is amplified by, you know, contemporary media. Social media is really what we're talking about, right? And then you turn back the clock and you think, well, there was no social media when Biggie and Tupac became hip-hop icons. You know, we're talking about word of mouth, MTV, mixtape trading, magazines like The Source.
Radio interviews.
Radio interviews.
Yeah.
Right? You know, you have these carefully cultivated images of Death Row and Bad Boy. You wonder how they might have been different if Twitter and Instagram had, you know, had existed back then. You know what I'm saying?
I actually think had Twitter and Instagram existed back then, the beef might actually have been distilled, right? Because Twitter and Instagram keeps a lot of things going that don't need to be kept going for a very long time. But so much of what Twitter especially kind of interjects into the conversation is so silly that it automatically kind of adds some levity to whatever the real issue might be. And then you think about Drake and Meek Mill, right? Drake and Meek Mill was probably the most serious, you know, hip hop, quote unquote beef, if you want to call it beef, that we've seen recently. But Drake turned it almost into a comedy routine, like just jokes and memes and, you know, all of that. And it diffused to me any potential of it ever going beyond that because it was all so silly. You know, I speculate often of what Pac would have been like on Twitter. I think he would have been a lot of ranting, a lot of energy. I don't think he would have been that different from Kanye, to be honest with you.
But Interesting.
But I think that had that existed back then, it probably would have diffused things a little bit because then I think both parties would have been more interested in letting it play out on stage so that the fans could be involved than it being a street thing. Which for the record, I think Biggie always wanted to keep it on wax and keep it on stage. I don't think he ever wanted this. I don't think he ever really returned the venom that Pac had for him.
Let's flip this thing around, though. I mean, social media has affected a lot of music careers, too. How do you think social media has changed the game in terms of who can actually rise to the top musically?
Well, the digital age and social media has definitely removed the need for gatekeepers or removed the usefulness of gatekeepers, I'll say. It has definitely allowed for artists to circumvent the need to, you know, try to call somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody to get their music played. But on the flip side, it has created this constant flow of content so that music cycles have shortened. There's so much more of an immediacy and a kind of transience to music because everything's on your phone.
Just a much more ephemeral thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a large majority of people out there, especially those who have grown up predominantly in the streaming era, who don't understand why you should ever pay for music. Why should you ever, right? So it's almost led to, you know, the sheer quantity of what's out there is almost kind of devalued the music itself. And even in hip hop, right? You have a handful of artists who have carried on a certain legacy of a kind of purity of hip hop. So on the women's side, we have Rhapsody, you know, who's a dynamic artist out of North Carolina. And, you know, you have Kendrick, some may argue, J. Cole, Cardi, who I think is a dynamic entertainer all around. She knows how to give mm-hmm. you the attitude. She knows how to make you believe it. Same with Megan, which takes more talent than I think people give credit for.
Naima, you almost sound optimistic. Am I picking up on a certain optimism?
There's some optimism coming
for the future of hip hop.
I think we're on an upswing, even though it's very frustrating to see people be faux critical of what women are doing as though any of this is new, as though any of this is truly scandalous in 2021, as though any of this merits pearl clutching. I also do, you know, see more women on the charts. You know, this idea that there can only be one has been dispelled. I don't know where it came from. But, you know, there was this idea that there was like a scarcity in terms of consumers and listenership that I think has gone away. In terms of women in hip hop and women in the music business in general, it unfortunately, you know, is going to long be considered. And this isn't just in hip hop. This is the music business in general is still considered kind of like a boys club. And it is still hard, no matter who you are, on the executive side, on the artist side, on the management side, to kind of hold the same weight in the room. But I think that people are kind of starting to stop and take stock and really give some acknowledgement of like, oh, you know, we can't make the excuse that consumers don't want it. Consumers clearly want it. We can't make the excuse that this wouldn't work. It clearly works. We just need to give it a shot. So hopefully we continue to see that grow.
Naima Cochran is a music and culture writer and a former music executive who helped build the careers of some of the biggest names in music. You can follow her on Twitter at StillNaima. That's StillNaima. Naima, thanks so much for joining us on Business Wars.
Thank you for having me, David.
Hey, Prime members, you can binge every episode of Business Wars ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
From Wondery, this is Episode 7 of Death Row vs. Bad Boy Records for Business Wars. I'm your host, David Brown. Kelly Kyle produced this episode. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor. Edited and produced by Emily Frost. Sound designed by Kyle Randall. Kate Young is our associate producer. Dave Schilling is our producer. Our executive producers are Jenny Lauer-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Created by Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loro, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.